Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
There's a lot that could impress you about the all-new Honda Prologue EV. True, it's got class-leading passenger space and clean, thoughtful design and intuitive technology. But what really sets the Prologue apart from the competition is that it's more than an EV. It's a Honda. Honda, the power of dreams. Visit Honda.com/Prologue to learn more.
Hello and welcome to a special bonus, dare I say, guerrilla edition of The Rest is History. A couple of weeks ago, Dominic and I did an episode on James Bond, timed to coincide with No Time to Die. At the time, of course, we hadn't seen it. Dominic, we now have, both of us, seen it.
Independently, I should say. We didn't go
independently,
together.
Independently, yes.
That'd be too much Rest is History for...
Yes. But here we are to perhaps just pick the bones of our viewing experience, not because this is turning into a cinema podcast, but because you are a top historian of modern Britain.
Possibly
the top historian of modern Britain.
That is kind.
And okay, no,
there,
Dominic,
there are academics all over Britain.
No, but like, Dominic, what I will say is that no one is better.
Yeah, nobody does it better.
No one does it better than you. at taking things that may not kind of seem obvious to hold a mirror up to British society, and you show that it does. So you do it with sport, you do it with music, and you do it with film.
That's very kind of you, Tom.
You know, I'm a massive fan.
You're a kind person.
So imagine that you are writing a history of Britain in the 2020s, in the 2050s or 60s. So let's hope you're still going on then. You know, Elon Musk has given you a kind of life serum or something to keep you on track.
Yeah.
What uses do you think you might put No Time to Die? Oh, and actually, before you answer that, I really need to flag up to anyone listening who's reached this far. This is going to be absolutely stuffed full with spoilers. And if you haven't seen the film and you want to see the film and you don't know what's going to happen, for goodness sake, don't listen to this, because this is going to be unapologetically full of spoilers.
That's very good advice.
Massive spoiler that we will undoubtedly be discussing. So,
yes.
So don't listen to this. If you want to see the film, you haven't seen it.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it, don't keep listening. I mean, that's a very weird thing to say in our own podcast. But well, the key thing to do is go to this film. Then as soon as you've got out of the film, listen to the podcast to find out what you should think of the film.
or rather, what top historian of modern Britain, Dominic Sambrook, thinks of the film. Because, Dominic, what would you say it tells us about modern Britain? Does it tell us about anything?
Yeah, of course it does. So in our Bond podcast, we talked about Bond as a symbol of Britishness. We talked about Bond and masculinity. And we talked about how that had changed, didn't we, between the books and the films and over the course of the films, so the different kind of incarnations of the character. And it's obviously a film... I mean, the portrait of masculinity in Daniel Craig's Bond has always been really interesting. So he's never had the insouciance of Roger Moore, has he, or of Connery. He's always been tortured and sort of troubled. And obviously in this film, he's in retirement at the beginning. So he's walked away from the Secret Service. And he has this sort of slightly... I mean, the film has great fun, doesn't it, with Bond as the kind of... He's become an outsider. So at one point he's working for the CIA. His number's been reassigned. And of course, given to a black woman. You know, the very antithesis of James Bond.
Yes. Okay. So on that, he's living in Jamaica.
Yeah.
He's retired to Jamaica.
Ian Fleming's
old haunt. Ian Fleming had done.
Yeah.
So he has basically become Ian Fleming.
Well,
you said that Ian Fleming, you know, even by the standards of the 1950s, was a massive reactionary.
Yes, I did.
And in moving to Jamaica to basically live this kind of expat colonial lifestyle, he's been replaced by as 007 by a black woman.
Yeah, but moving to Jamaica has different connotations now than it would have done in the 1950s.
Yeah, but they must be playing with that, don't you?
Yeah, they are playing with that. But obviously he's moved to Jamaica in a very kind of cool way. He's hanging around and fishing and he's...
Yeah, but so you could say that Ian Fleming did. I mean, I do think that there is tension there between the...
I don't think
the past of Bond and perhaps the future of Bond.
I think that's absolutely true. When he first meets his replacement, she pretends to be a local. She's disguised as a local, isn't she? She offers him a lift on the back of her moped or motorbike or whatever it is.
Which, of course, is also brilliant. You know, it's not just about race, it's also about gender.
Yeah,
it's now
absolutely.
The man clinging on to the woman as they ride on the bike.
Exactly. And then, obviously, I thought that was very well handled, the stuff with him and his replacement. Because, of course, the film is... I mean, in some quarters, you've seen people saying, it's 00 woke or whatever, which I think is ridiculous. Because actually, I think the film is having quite a lot of fun with that. The filmmakers are kind of amused with the idea that a black woman is the new 007. And they, you know, all those moments when they walk back through MI6 later in the film and people say, oh, hello, 007, to the two of them.
Yes.
I thought that was brilliantly done, actually. I thought that was very funny. And not, they didn't sort of lay it on too thick. But obviously what that's sort of playing with is the idea that you see in The Guardian every time a Bond film is brought out, that Bond is outdated. So we talked about this in our podcast 2 weeks ago, and lo and behold, about 3 days after our podcast went out, The Guardian ran their obligatory 1,200 word, why it's now time to retire James Bond.
Did it appear in their excellent Saturday supplement?
It might have done. Is that what you've been publicising on this podcast behind my back?
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, not that I don't endorse all your own endorsements, obviously, but I may raise an eyebrow Roger Moore style at some of them. So the film's obviously having some fun with that. Craig seems old in the film.
Well, he's old, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he looks old. He plays him as an old
Because after he went to the premiere and he wore a kind of pink jacket.
He did.
There were lots of discussions on fashion, you know, can men over 50 wear pink jackets?
Which,
as a man over 50, I read with someone, yes, apparently they can.
Do you own a pink jacket?
I should be investing in one.
Forthwith.
Imminently.
Right, yeah. Very good. So I think there's that. I think the anxiety, Bond films are always quite good on the anxieties, good little windows into the anxieties of the day. So, for example, in the 70s, about energy, The Man with the Golden Gun was all about sort of solar energy and stuff, obviously the age of the oil crisis. And this is about nanobots that will kill everybody with a virus. Now, interestingly, it's a virus, you know, that predates the pandemic.
Yes, and it's a virus that gets kind of unleashed from a laboratory.
Yeah,
and it's kind of weird that it got shot before COVID. I mean, famously, it's been parked for basically 2 years.
But we live in an age when people are obsessed with these kinds of threats, aren't they? Even before the pandemic, we were obsessed with the dangers of science, the dangers of artificial intelligence, of messing with DNA, which this film is, you know, that's what this virus is all about, isn't it? It targets your individual DNA.
I think, it also highlights the way in which I think our response to the virus as it hit, in a sense, had already been scripted for us by films like this.
Yeah.
That anxieties about viruses escaping from labs and kind of spreading across the world. I mean, it's an absolute staple of science fiction, of zombie films,
yes,
of Planet of the Apes, of all that kind of stuff. And I wonder whether the reluctance of people to countenance the theory that COVID might have escaped from a laboratory in Wuhan was, in a sense, precisely because it seemed too much of a staple.
I'm sure that's true, Tom.
From a thriller.
I think that's absolutely true. I think... some listeners may remember, some of the older listeners may remember a series in the 1970s called Survivors, set in a kind of post-apocalyptic Britain. And the title sequence of that always started with a Chinese-looking scientist dropping a kind of test tube or something. It's a brilliant title sequence, actually. You see it on YouTube. And it breaks and shatters. And then you see him on various planes crossing the world. And I always thought, as COVID started to spread, I couldn't help thinking of this title sequence, and exactly as you say, you sort of think to yourself, well, because I've seen it in fictional entertainment, it therefore can't happen, and it will be a ludicrous conspiracy theory if I kind of gave into it. But anyway, we're getting off topic.
I don't think it is off topic, because I thought another kind of very I mean, in a way, it seems prophetic, but I guess it's just kind of working out the trends in geopolitics, is that it ends on an island kind of between Russia and Japan. Yeah. with China lurking in the background. And this is an island of the kind that is an absolute staple of Bond films. You know, it always ends up on islands. It's usually, you know, nuclear missiles and people running around in tracksuits and all that kind of stuff.
Tracksuits?
Well, don't they? I mean, I remember in the 70s.
They're wearing kind of
boiler suits.
The
Roger Moore ones. Yeah. They're kind of boiler suits. Or, yeah. Yes, boiler
I mean, they're
suits,
not wearing shell suits. That would be hilarious.
I was thinking they were wearing kind of, yes, tight-fitting shell suits.
Yeah.
And these islands always kind of seem to exist in the middle of nowhere. It's not like they have any kind of geopolitical resonance at all.
That's
They're
right.
Abstracted from reality. Whereas this one is. And
it's Cold War relic, isn't it?
But it's an Indo-Pacific flashpoint. It's because you've got Russian, Chinese, Japanese forces wondering what the hell the British are doing there.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of British task force sailing through, as it's been doing in the past few weeks, and it kind of hints at the, you know, the row about the submarine program.
Yes,
the US UK Australian submarine program.
This is where World War III will start in real life. That's what you're saying.
So in a sense, like, you can imagine the script writers kind of looking ahead when they start. I don't know when they started writing it, 2015, 2016, yeah, something like that, and saying, well, where might the world be, you know, in 2020?
That's what James Bond films often do, Tom, I think. They absolutely do that. They try to anticipate the, you know, we were chuckling in one of our previous podcasts. Well, we're chuckling in all of them, but we were chuckling in one of them about the Mujahideen in The Living Daylights, you know, and that now feels like absolutely of its moment. James Bond would have gone to Afghanistan in the mid-1980s and kind of got involved with the Mujahideen. They're very good, I think, at kind of getting what's in the air.
But getting a virus and a Pacific shipping lane tensions,
yeah,
right? I mean, it's pretty good, I thought.
Yeah, it is good. But I mean, Bond is so the base is sort of. The fact that it's a Cold War relic, I mean, Bond himself is a Cold War relic, right? I think it's the end of the Second World War, is it? Sort of bunker, and there's pictures of Stalin and stuff in there. So it feels kind of, that's a kind of a nice little nod back to Fleming and the sort of original roots of Bond, exactly.
Yeah, so right the way through, you have kind of nods, knowing nods to its origins with Ian Fleming.
Yeah,
in
absolutely.
The 50s.
But obviously Ian Fleming would have been appalled by this film.
Well, okay. Well, let's take a break now, because, you know, this is just a short one. We shouldn't go on too long. And when we come back, let's talk about that. Let's talk about what Ian Fleming would have made of it.
Okay.
There's a lot that could impress you about the all-new Honda Prologue EV. True, it's got class-leading passenger space and clean, thoughtful design and intuitive technology. But what really sets the Prologue apart from the competition is that it's more than an EV. It's a Honda. Honda, the power of dreams. Visit honda.com/prologue to learn more.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest Is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest Is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to this special Bond-themed bonus film reviewing episode of The Rest Is History. Tom, actually, there is a reason why we're doing a film review episode, isn't there? It's not just because we've already done our James Bond podcast. It's because we want to do some shameless promotion for ourselves.
We do. Yes, we do.
So on the 14th of November, Sunday the 14th of November, we are making, I wouldn't quite call it a big screen debut, but there will be a big screen. So we are performing, bizarrely, at the Odeon Leicester Square as part of something called Podicon. And we will be doing a special Rest Is History. You can buy the tickets on Ticketmaster. I don't have the link, but if you type Ticketmaster, Rest Is History.
Well, we'll put Podicon. It on Twitter. Link to our advert for this show.
We will be talking, won't we, about history and films. We haven't really settled on our list yet. I think there'll be some dispute about which films we want to do, but I know which films I want to do. I want to do Alexander Nevsky. I want to do Birth of a Nation. I'm sure we'll talk about Gladiator. I know you're a big fan of Braveheart, Tom.
Yeah, well, there's also a Russian film that features the worst bottom ever to appear, I think, in any film, certainly that I've seen.
Yeah. Who knew that you were such a connoisseur?
Well, it's an absolutely terrifying portrayal of life in medieval Russia. And I suspect that might feature as well, because we're not doing kind of like the best films, are we, or anything like that. We're going to try and find kind of interesting categories, odd categories, a kind of range of familiar films, a range of less familiar films, and hopefully it'll be good. Anyway, it's absolute bargain. What could be more fun on a Sunday afternoon?
I think
afternoon
it's about 5 o'clock, isn't hearing it? Us. 5 o'clock Sunday afternoon. I mean, let's face it, you're not going to be doing anything else. So come to this thing, you can see us, and you can laugh at Tom's choice of bottom-related films.
Yes.
So, James Bond, we're about to talk about what Ian Fleming would have made of it. Well, first of all, Tom, what did you make of it, deep down?
Okay, I thought it was too long. That's
madness, by the way.
I just thought, you know, I kind of drifted off at one point, woke up and they were still shooting each other. And also, okay, so I thought that Rami Malek, who's the villain, I thought was terrible.
Shocking.
And the reason for that was that I thought he'd been so brilliant as Freddie Mercury
in the
biopic about Queen. He's really wonderful about that. And he's still basically playing Freddie Mercury, it seemed to me.
That's all
right. So I kept waiting for him to start singing We Are the Champions or something.
I thought he was good. I thought he was kind of sinister. I thought he was creepy.
Okay, but here's the thing. He is physically deformed.
He's Lucifer Saffin. His name, isn't it? It's a very good name.
It's classic, kind of great Bond name. But he's kind of physically deformed. You know, in the episode we did on Bond, we discussed this, how Ian Fleming always makes his villains physically deformed.
Three nipples, very hairy.
Three nipples, no earlobes, all that kind of stuff. Now, it's a sign of the times that this has provoked quite a lot of controversy. That it's kind of ableist.
Oh, right.
That it's casting...
It's discriminating against the ugly...
It's discriminating people who look like sinister Bond villains.
Right.
And that this is unacceptable.
Yeah.
And in a sense, it's a kind of classic example of the kind of headwinds that anyone setting out to make a classic Bond film are now facing.
You're not allowed to have grotesque villains. Do you know, that's interesting, because only yesterday I was writing an article. I wrote an anniversaries piece for BBC History Magazine, which began with the words, "The Emperor Vitellius was a very fat man." And they said, "Could you change that?" And I said, "Very greedy." And I said, "Well, no, I think he was very fat." And
he was fat.
And it amuses me.
Him now,
I just wanted to start with a bang. And they went, And obviously you're not really, you know, that's sort of slightly seen as sort of, you know, middle-aged men punching down by calling Roman emperors fat.
Well, I mean, this actually reminds this. It reminds me of the discussion we had about 300.
Yeah.
Where FBLT's the traitor is a kind of hideous hunchback, a cripple.
Yeah.
And the format of films now generally is that if someone like that appears in a film and he wants to join a band of brothers, then he will be able to do it. And he will probably play some kind of moving, starring role.
He will. He'll rescue them.
He'll bring a message and die heroically or something like that. The thing that's kind of shocking and a little bit, actually very, very true to ancient Greece, is that he is as kind of morally depraved as he is physically revolting.
Yeah.
And that's very true to how the Greeks saw the world. The Greeks absolutely kind of equated physical beauty with moral beauty.
Like Ian Fleming.
So Ian Fleming seems to have done the same.
Yeah.
But clearly, this is something that is treading on all kinds of, setting off all kinds of moral tripwires.
Well, not for the makers of the James Bond films, because Rami Malek's character is hideous, but also bad.
So but I wonder, you know, if they make another one, whether they will take on board those criticisms.
Maybe have a very ugly James Bond and a very good looking villain.
Possibly.
Yeah, I should look forward to that.
Actually, to be fair, Daniel Craig is, I mean, he's not classically handsome, is he?
No, he's not, but James Bond himself isn't really meant to be classically handsome. I mean, I remember reading out in the podcast that strange line, those lines in Moonraker, the novel where Fleming says, you know,
yes,
he looks not English and he looks something dark and all this sort of stuff. I thought the villain was, he was a kind of traditional Bond villain, wasn't he? He's got a plan. A slightly undefined plan to kind of kill lots of people. He says, we both eradicate people, we both clean up the world, I just want to do it in a neater way than you. They do that thing in the film that now, in the last 20 years, has become very common. Christopher Nolan does it a lot in his Dark Knight films, where the villain says to Bond, we're not so different, you and I. You know, that kind of thing.
Okay, so Dominic, yes. Okay, so on that topic, you asked me what I thought of it. I also thought that it was to Adam West's Batman what the Dark Knight films became. So
yeah, so it is to Roger Moore as yes, Christopher Nolan is to Adam West, as it were.
Yes.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And not least because the soundtrack is done by the same person who does Hans Zimmer, who does the soundtrack for all those Christopher Nolan films. So it felt very Christopher Nolan-like, I thought. And a sort of gritty, urban kind of feel to it. The washed-out colours and stuff.
And so bearing that in mind, going back to the figure of Bond as an embodiment of masculinity.
Yeah.
In this film, he has a wife. Is he married to?
No, he's not married, but she's clearly a girlfriend, which he hasn't. He only had a very fleeting girlfriend in the very first couple of films. She was called Sylvia Trench, I think, and he met her twice, but she wasn't serious. This is the first time he's had a serious, lasting love interest with Madeleine, the Proustian Madeleine Swann.
But not only does he have a girlfriend. Massive spoiler alert coming up if you haven't already switched.
So Harry, our producer, has not seen the film, and yet he's being forced,
he's got to edit this.
forced to listen to this and edit it. And we sort of said to him, "Stop, you know, try and mute it." He said, "I can't." So
he also has a daughter.
He does have a daughter. Yeah.
And so when he's saving the world, he is basically he's saving his wife, his girlfriend. And
well, there's that scene where he's running through the base where he's got Dudu,
the abandoned
her soft
toy,
kind of stuck in his belt or something or in his pocket.
So is that basically now? Is that what a kind of classic Bond figure has to do in a film to get away with all his kind of masculine saving the world?
A little bit. I mean, people
Does he have to kind of child stuff toy in the back of his?
I think people have been doing that for about 20 or 30 years, and
have they been doing it in Bond films?
But not in Bond films, and that's the sort of, and that's. But that's the incongruity of it in a Bond film, because, of course, part of the point of the Bond character is that he is liberated from all of those.
Yeah, he has nothing.
From any domestic ties. He has his parents are dead. He floats free of human associations. So to give him those associations, I mean, I think once you've done that, you can't really do it again. I mean, in future Bond films, he can't be, you know, preparing the sandwiches for a children's party. or something. I mean, that would obviously be ludicrous. So, or going to B&Q to get some stuff. He can't do any of that. So I think that's...
But he'd get elite service in B&Q, wouldn't he? He'd be recognised in B&Q.
Oh, Mr. Bond.
Your usual plywood.
Yeah. Exactly. I think, this is part of the sort of, you know, all this talk about toxic masculinity and stuff. This is kind of playing with that, isn't it? That Bond is, you know, it's the shock when he sees he has a daughter. You know, the ultimate threat to James Bond's mystique. He'll have to, you know, take her to the loo when they go to the cinema or whatever. I think that's kind of fun, but they can't do it again. I mean, as soon as I saw the daughter, I thought, he'll have that. You know, this will not end well for Daniel Craig's James Bond because
it's just that,
they can't envisage a future with him with the daughter.
Yeah. But I mean, the archetype, which is obviously a very very ancient one, of a man rescuing a woman.
Yeah,
which is basically what this film is about. At the end of the day.
Well, so many Bond films are about, right? I mean, how many of the final kind of climactic confrontations of Bond films are Bond rescuing the girl from the villain's, you know, revenge or whatever?
But again, I mean, is that kind of basic plot something? I mean, clearly, it's a basic plot that has to be complicated now in a way that it wasn't, say, in the 60s.
It's only marginally complicated, though, isn't it? I mean, he goes to the base. He's determined to rescue his girlfriend and his daughter. He does rescue them, and he does save the world, but obviously at tremendous cost to himself. I mean, that's as you say, it's almost like a mythical story. I mean, Bond, and actually I was only thinking about this the other day after we did our Bond podcast. Bond is a mythical character.
Yeah.
When future generations, you said, what will people in 2050 make of this? The sort of more interesting question in a weird way, is what will people in the 31st century make of it? And they will probably look on Bond much as we look on Heracles or Achilles. They'll say, well, these characters in the sort of, these punters in the late 20th, early 21st century invested this character with tremendous importance. They bought things that he wore. They modelled themselves on him. They knew he wasn't real, but they kind of wished that he was, you know.
Well,
they made podcasts about him.
You mentioned Heracles. Heracles ends up on a funeral pyre, burning to death.
Yes.
And there are the Greeks had two views on what happened next. The first was that he was claimed by a chariot, taken up to Olympus, and basically became immortal. And the second is that he died. Now, massive spoiler klaxon coming up. At the end of this film, James Bond gets hit by a rain of missiles that descend and destroy this breeding ground for the plague that's going to wipe out the world. So the world is saved, but Bond isn't saved. He dies.
Yeah.
So what does that mean for the franchise, do you think?
I actually don't think it means as much as people think. Now, previously what happened at the end of each Bond was they were simply replaced and the franchise continued. There was on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which we didn't talk about at all last time, which is the obvious precursor to this film. There are tons of nods to it.
And there's kind of homage in this one, isn't there?
In the music.
Music.
And in lines, we have all the time in the world. Yeah. It's the last line of On Her Majesty's Secret Service when Bond's wife, Tracy, Diana Rigg, is killed. So there is a kind of precedent in that they have put in 1969, they pushed the formula. They killed the Bond girl in the final moments of the film. I remember my mum telling me that when she went to see that with my dad, she cried at the end, and lots of people were crying in the cinema when Diana Rigg's character was killed. So unexpected to anyone who hadn't read the book. I think, normally what happens is they don't mention any kind of transition. Obviously, what they're going to do is reboot it. They'll do what they do with Marvel, with Spider-Man or something. They'll start again with a new M. I mean, that's what I would do. Start again with a new M, a new Q, a new Moneypenny, new setup, new Bond. There's no need to even refer to the fact that this has happened.
But do you think that they might kind of make a virtue of the fact that it was originated in the 50s?
And go back and start it, set it in the 50s again?
Yeah.
I did wonder that, and I think no, because Bond is, that would then lose the, that would make Bond a period piece. the lasting appeal of Bond is the modernity, right? Is that he has the latest technology, the latest look, you know, the coolest new pop star does the music. You know, they have the sort of stars of the day in cameo roles and things. They lose that, don't they, when they go back to the 50s? Suddenly, Bond in time.
But it just felt with this one that they were kind of pushing the potential that exists within the character and the narrative setup to kind of be squared with the incredibly different mores of the 21st century. They kind of pushed it almost to a break. I mean, literally to a breaking point. I mean, to the point where they basically had to kill him.
I agree with you to some extent.
And I kind of wonder where do you go after that?
Well, I think there's a good precedent for that, and we've already mentioned it in this podcast, which is Batman. So Batman, mid-20th century character. There were various iterations, obviously. And then Christopher Nolan and Christian Bale do the Dark Knight films, which are very dark, very gritty, the most realistic kind of version of Batman there has been. And there have been attempts to do Batman since, and none of them have really, you know, with Ben Affleck and stuff, and none of them have really worked, because there was a sense that that iteration of the franchise had pushed the concept as far as you could possibly push it. And it'd be interesting to see how they... I would have said the only way you can do James Bond after this is to do it in a very light way. Get back to a kind of sense of fun. You know, it's not all his... You know, there's a sense in this film that James Bond's not really enjoying himself, isn't there? I mean, he's never enjoying himself in this film.
But the problem with that is that you've got Austin Powers and...
I don't think
Kingsman
that's a problem. I just don't think that's a problem. I think if you have a very cool star who people want to see, and they know it's a fun iteration, and it's a good, lighthearted kind of 2 hours of entertainment, I think people will still want to see it. If you make it desirable, I think... I can't see that there's anything to be gained from pushing this version of the myth, as it were, into darker and darker territory.
So just to return to the question we began with, you're writing the history of the 2020s.
Yeah.
Is this a film that would merit a chapter?
A chapter? Whole chapter.
Or just a paragraph, or just a sentence?
I think maybe a page. I think maybe a page. And where I would put it? I probably wouldn't put it in a sort of pandemic section. I put it about, I mean, certainly the thing with Bond and his replacement is really a fun way of introducing a section about the sort of challenge to the kind of white masculinity and stuff, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
you know, MI6 of the new face of MI6 is a black woman. I think that's very much of the moment. And I thought that, I think the sort of, you know, the sense of, we live in an age, it's obsessed in many ways with, people say interrogating, I don't want to use the jargon, with sort of tearing down the imaginative world that you and I grew up with, which was an imaginative world of forged in the kind of Second World War and the early Cold War. You know, sort of Biggles, comics about the Second World War, the Dambusters on TV about every 2 weeks, that kind of thing. And you could see this as the kind of culmination of that. This is really just sort of demolishing all of that.
Well, it opens with kind of Britannia as a great sunken statue.
That's right.
I mean, she's been toppled. Britannia has been toppled into the ocean.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Half sunk beneath sand.
Yeah. And I think, it sort of ends. There's that sort of... I thought they ended it very well, actually. So Bond is dead. There's the scene in the pub where M, Q, Moneypenny, Bond's replacement, Nomi, I think that's probably it, are sitting around having a scotch. And he says a few lines from Jack London, and then they say, right, back to work. But then it cuts to Madeleine Swann and the daughter driving through, you know, some classic Bond landscape. And she says, I'm going to tell you a story about a man called Bond, James Bond. And that kind of, I'm going to tell you a story. I mean, that felt very kind of mythic, you know. Bond is a story.
So maybe that's where they go into something that is kind of more overtly mythic.
Yeah, I think so. Do you think it's a stretch to call Bond mythic? I mean, you deal in myths every day.
No, I think absolutely. Yeah, completely. Right. I think that maybe the best way to end this would be for you to read out the...
Yeah. It could be talking about Tom Holland of The Rest Is History, but it's actually talking about James Bond, and it was written by Jack London in 1916. The proper function of man is to live, not to exist. I shall not waste my days in trying to prolong them. I shall use my time in making history podcasts. And with that, don't forget to get your tickets for the Odeon Leicester Square on Sunday the 14th of November, where you will see Tom and I in person talking about history and films. Very exciting. And we shall see you next time. As they say, the rest is history. Will return.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.